Hello and welcome back to at least me being here this week. Francesca Fiorentini and Brett Ehrlich held down the damage port yesterday. They shipped me off to the woods. I got lost in the mountains, but I'm back after just a few days and very excited to be doing the news once again because it's America and it's politics. What could go wrong? But I know one thing that hasn't gone wrong, and that is the co-hosting situation for today. Today I am very happy to be joined by writer, vlogger, and social political commentator, Yasmin Aliyah Khan. Welcome back to the damage port.
Hi, John. It's good to be back. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you here. How were your holidays?
The holidays were good. They're a little bit different this year. Christmas will also be different this year, but I've already got some trees up behind me. I broke my own rule this year. I usually don't do any kind of Christmas decoration until after Thanksgiving, but this year I feel like I earned a little bit of extra Christmas. So
I think considering all that's been going on, going overboard with the Christmas decorations, probably not a bad idea. I might have to do that.
Yeah, I think it's merited this year.
Yeah, my wife and I last year, we got like a little tree because we live in a very small apartment. I'm gonna start looking. I wonder when those tree places start setting up in LA. If it's there today, I might get a tree today because that'll make me feel better. But anyway, I heard you made a lot of pies.
So I did make a lot of pies. Yeah, I'm a baker. I like to bake. So I made a lot of pies and this year I just delivered a bunch of them instead of, you know, taking them and having pie and tea with my friends. I just delivered them and left. So
that does sound great. I'm looking forward to my mom growing up made a lot of cookies. Every year the same cookies and I got recipes last year. So I'm looking forward to making those again. That's how I'm going to spend the holidays.
Oh, yeah, I've already started experimenting with my cookie recipes for Christmas. So nice. Way ahead of you.
Awesome. Okay. Well, I don't mind you beating me as long as you post pictures of the cookies. Thank you to everybody who's already here. We're going to be talking about pies, cookies, and eventually politics. Thank you for being here. Please hit the like button, share the stream if you haven't already. And if you want to chat along, as many of you are, I've got the YouTube and the Twitch chat open right now, or send us super chats or tweets or anything like that. I'll be responding as we go. There's a lot that we're going to be talking about through the course of this hour. Not only Donald Trump launching a war on the GOP, we've got a shaking up of the National Coronavirus Task Force. We've got Joe Biden supposedly breaking a bone, but that's just the cover story the deep state wants you to believe. And Ben Shapiro, what's he whining about this week? Well, we've got that for you if there's time to close out the show. With that, Yasmin, you ready to launch into this thing?
Yeah, I am. I'm ready.
Okay, let's do this. When I left about a week ago, Donald Trump hadn't yet accepted that he had lost the election and he was very, very angry at everyone who was implying that he had. Well, a lot has changed since then. This week, he's refusing to accept that he lost the election and he's really, really mad at all the Republicans who insist that he did. There's not a lot, but there are a few. And they're in important positions in the states that he would really have preferred to win. And so he's lashing out at them. All the GOP effectively going under the bus today. He tweeted, "Do something, Brian Kemp. You allowed your state to be scammed. We must check signatures and count signed envelopes against ballots. Then call off election. It won't be needed. We will all win." So it's this thing where he thinks that there's something with the signatures that would apparently not only fix the deficit that he has of a little bit more than, I think, 12,000 votes in that state. It depends on the state. In some, he got absolutely destroyed in. This one was a little bit closer. But that also then you wouldn't have to have the runoff elections, which are coming up soon. Like, it's very fanciful thinking. It's sort of the power of positive thinking. Just, you know, put your wishes out there into the universe. But Brian Kemp is a Republican governor that has increasingly been vilified by right-wing media and right-wing politicians. It's gonna be interesting to see how long this sticks to him, Yasmin, as a result of him just acknowledging what happened in this election.
To Trump or to Kemp? Because with Kemp,
it's
interesting. Yeah, with Kemp, it's interesting because of everything that happened with his own election as governor. And it's really hard for Trump to make this case that, you know, there's a lot of corruption in Georgia, especially since a lot of their election officials are members of the GOP. So he's kind of fighting with himself, but it's working out for us because it just means that there's more infighting with the Georgia Republicans. And a lot of them are boycotting the election now, the runoff election. So maybe we could have a shot at the Senate, you know? So I'm very hesitantly hopeful. that somebody on the ground is organizing better than the Georgia GOP right now.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, no, you're totally right to point out that Brian Kemp, like we can't know for sure. It's the nature of voter suppression, probably stole his gubernatorial win against Stacey Abrams because he made it so, he and other Republicans made it so difficult to vote. Yeah. Like he did the one thing, sorry, there's two things Republicans want you to do. Give tax cuts to the wealthy and make it so that non-white people can't vote in America. He did that second one. Why are you so mad at him? But they are mad. And like I said, I don't know how long it's gonna stick to him. At some point, we'll be past Trump's complaining about the election. We're just not there quite yet. But it got even funnier with Trump's like ongoing multi-week hissy fit because Arizona was recently one of the states that certified the election results. Doesn't mean that they like that Trump lost. A lot of these, like in this case, are controlled by Republicans, but they do have to accept reality. And it got sort of funny. So I want to play you a video. This is of Governor Ducey during the certification, and you might be able to catch an interesting sound in the background. Okay, so it's very hard to hear, but if you listen very carefully and try a few times, Yasmin, do you know where I'm going with this? Do you know what's in that video?
Yeah, I know what's in the video. Okay. I'll let you.
Yeah, really fast because it is hard to actually hear it, but you hear when he takes his phone out, it is playing Hail to the Chief, and supposedly, I'm not staking my reputation on this, but supposedly he had previously said that so as to not miss a call from the president, he had changed the president's ringtone to Hail to the Chief. And so it seems like, as happened in other states, I believe this happened in Michigan, where Trump called them up to talk during the certification, and he talked during the certification, it's all on video, that he tried to call Ducey, and Ducey just sent him the voicemail, which I just love. Although if I was Ducey, I'd be worried for my life right now.
Yeah, I mean, good for him for sending the president a voicemail. It's so funny because all these GOP officials now are, you know, being more open about the fact that he really is just like a petulant child, kind of like your annoying friend or annoying boss in this case. And he calls and you're just like, oh God, I can't deal with this guy right now. So maybe there's some hope that there are still some adults in the room who are willing to take a step against Trump. One could argue very easily, I would say, that it's too little too late, but at least it's something at this point.
Yeah. Yeah, and look, it's not just Trump is pissed at Ducey, for instance. And he's tweeting about them. Like we showed you the tweet of him attacking Brian Kemp, and obviously like this is the thing Republicans worry about. It is Donald Trump attacking them on Twitter. You can call it cowardly, you can call it pragmatic, since a lot of his followers just do what he says and believe what he wants them to. But this is what they're worried about. But he's also retweeting people. So he retweeted Paul Cizpula, I guess, who says, why is Doug Ducey still pretending he's a member of the Republican Party after he just certified fraudulent election results in Arizona that disenfranchised millions of Republicans? And then he did the Charlie Kirk thing where he put a thinking face so that you'll think that he did. But anyway, yeah, so now Doug Ducey, according to Trump's retweet, and technically retweets are not endorsements, although we all know that they really are, Ducey isn't really a Republican anymore because he certified the election results. Brian Kemp, presumably not a Republican anymore. There's a lot of Republicans who just think they're Republicans, according to the leader of the Republican Party at this point.
Yeah, it's always kind of interesting to dictate to somebody else what they believe or don't believe in, actually. It's kind of a weird thing to start off with. But then, I mean, Ducey and Kemp, both of them were very Trump supportery governors. You know, so it is a stretch to all of a sudden be like, oh, they're not really Republicans, when just, you know, a few weeks ago, they were some of his biggest surrogates. And then on top of that, with Ducey, this whole election issue has kind of brought to my attention just the fallibility of human error, you know, how easy it is to overturn the entire system just if somebody decides to not do their job properly or at all, as we also have seen. And yeah. I don't know what that means for elections going forward. It feels very archaic and obsolete to me that we're still hand counting ballots or even submitting paper ballots. But I mean, that gets into a whole lot of other issues with, you know, election security and things like that. But
yeah,
it doesn't inspire a lot of confidence as far as election security going forward.
Yeah. Yeah. And look, I personally think that we can have it both ways, I guess. We can make sure that we have the hard copy so that we have a paper trail, but we could also provide a long enough period of voting beforehand and allowing the votes to be counted before the election, even if it's just an early count that could potentially be amended if somebody changes their vote or something, so that we're not waiting a long time and we can give them the resources to do it expeditiously. I think that we could do that. We've chosen not to as a country, or at least one party.
To be clear also, there are a lot of ways to ensure election security and better elections. It's just a matter of whether or not they're actually going to do them. You know, totally. And all the everything you just said, and then some. There's a lot of ways to have free and fair elections, and we're just not doing them right now.
Yeah, but there's a couple more wrinkles to this. Donald Trump really wants you to believe that he's still in this thing, and he can't necessarily always articulate exactly why. So he's been doing a lot of retweeting, and the thing is, you go to war with the tweeters you can retweet, not necessarily the tweeters you wish you could retweet. And so what does Trump have? Well, Trump has Cat Turd. No, really, it's an account called Cat Turd that he has been retweeting in support of himself in the election. So Cat Turd says, Rudy Giuliani is presenting a ton of evidence. If you ignore or refuse to look at the mountain of evidence being presented, save your breath barking to us about there being no evidence. You can't have it both ways. Yasmin, those are strong words from Cat Turd, who also says, they never thought Trump and we the people would call bull-ass and fight back hard. They were wrong. Well, there I take issue with Cat Turd's argument there, because we always knew Trump wasn't going to accept the results if he lost. He was very clear about that. That's the sort of like insipid, stupid thing that you say that sounds strong, like they didn't think we'd realize it and fight. But no, we always knew that you were gonna whine and complain, Cat Turd. Not you necessarily, I don't prejudge Cat Turd, but Trump definitely was never gonna accept the results.
I mean, we do have to acknowledge the wisdom of Cat Turd. I don't even like saying that, it feels dirty.
I don't either, but I'm getting
it's so silly. But yeah, it's a lot of posturing and, you know, pumping out your chest or whatever, peacocking. And it's like, yeah, we all knew you were gonna do this. Everything was laid out. Nothing unpredictable has happened thus far regarding the 2020 election. I haven't been surprised yet. I can't imagine that a lot of Damage Report viewers are surprised either. You know, it's all been there.
Yeah, Trump, he's been doing what we expect. And look, I'm glad that there have been, like, some of these Republican governors have been willing to acknowledge reality. I did think that there would be fewer Republicans totally going along with this, that the Jim Jordans and all of that would just be nonstop tweeting crazy conspiracy theories. They've all become Trump effectively. But this is where it gets even more interesting, because he's doing all of this retweeting in support of himself. Most of it Cat Turd related, but not all of it. And some of it isn't just about his frustrations with the election that just finished. Some of it is pointing forward towards the next election. So Carmine Sabia, who the president of the United States retweeted, who is this person? I have no idea. I doubt he does either. But this is who the most powerful individual in the world chose to retweet, says, watching the Arizona hearings and then watching Governor Ducey sign those papers, why bother voting for Republicans if what you get is Ducey and Kemp? And this is amazing, because think about what he's saying there. So he's retweeting, don't vote Republican if you just get people like this. And one of the states where you get people like Kemp is Georgia, where the two runoff elections are about to happen. So Trump is retweeting people saying, don't bother voting Republican when there is an election in like 3 weeks or something. Even though he's at the same time also saying, the elections don't even need to happen because the Republicans already won them. So he's saying, don't vote for the Republicans. And why would you have to? Because we already won it. It's unnecessary. But he's also planning to travel to Georgia to get people to vote for the Republicans that he doesn't think you should vote for. And you also don't need to vote for, because the election's unnecessary because they already won it. And this is the sort of way that Republicans can be sort of mentally flexible. All of that makes sense to them. All of these seemingly self-contradictory statements about what needs to be done in a few weeks, but they've made some sense out of it.
What did you say? Mentally flexible? That's brilliant. That's perfect. That's what it is. Because even as you were detailing everything about that tweet, my own brain, I was just like, what? Like, none of this makes sense. And I had like 1,000 questions while you were talking. And then I was like, oh yeah, they're very mentally flexible. That's exactly what it is. Or just willing to accept or not accept things that don't fit in with their. And I've always said that the one thing that the Republican Party has over the Democrats, including the progressives, is that they all fall in line. No matter how ridiculous it is, they all stay on message. And that's, you know, a lesson that we all got from Leslie Knope on Parks and Rec. You just got to stay on message. They got it. The Democrats didn't. So that's why they won in 2016, I think.
And just briefly, I want to just read a few people who are a little bit worried about some of this rhetoric from the president about the fact that you shouldn't vote. So let's see, Eric Johnson's campaign advisor to Kelly Loeffler, one of the two that's having her runoff election in the very near future. He says, you can't say the system is rigged, but elect these two senators. At some point, he either drops it or he says, I want everybody to vote and get their friends to vote so that the margins are so large that they can't steal it. So he's even giving Trump the option of keeping up the this entire thing is rigged thing by just twisting it to be like it's rigged. So you definitely need to vote so that we have enough to overcome the rigging. But he's worried about it because he is being paid to get Kelly Loeffler elected. And the president that he probably worships as his own personal deity is implying that maybe you shouldn't vote for her. But it's not just him. Buzz Brockway, real human, former Republican state representative, says, I had someone message me just last week saying, nope, I'm done. Can't trust the election, never voting again. The president has a very dedicated group of supporters who don't really support the broader Republican Party. They support him. And look, I'm not gonna show you the images, but apparently on Parler, there's this boycott brewing of people either saying they're not gonna vote in the runoffs or they're just gonna write in Trump. I don't know, Yasmin, do you think that is actually going to impact the vote totals? Does it matter at this point, or is that just like a social media stunt?
I feel like I'm inclined to say it's a social media stunt, but a lot of the people on Parler are those Republicans who do go out and vote. You know, just demographically, they're the ones who vote more than typically every other group really in the United States, especially in a place like Georgia. So I don't know if it would make a huge difference. It kind of is reminiscent of a lot of progressives who wanted to boycott the 2020 election. And then people were like, you know, you need solidarity versus division. So it is interesting to kind of see it mirrored, but bastardized on the other side. You know, you have, I think it comes down to motivation. You know, what are they actually afraid of? What are they trying to do? And will it be effective? I don't think it'll change much ultimately.
You have to balance they're really bad, and and everyone that they look up to and trust, whether in politics or media, has been telling them this entire thing is fraudulent, you're being lied to, and everybody's a traitor, by the way. Everybody is backstabbing Trump and making it so that he didn't win, but you should totally vote. So they're really mad, but at the same time, they don't want Biden to have unified control of two branches of government. And so I don't know.
I wonder if they know why they're mad. You know, like they're mad about these fraudulent elections, and the proof that they've been given is not proof at all. But I guess their mental flexibility is like, no, this counts, this works. Even though here's all the evidence that it doesn't work. Ducey even, you know, he was saying we hand count our ballots and we hand validate the signatures on them. You know, these people are working really, really hard through the holidays even now to verify these election results. And you have people who are still trying to sabotage it well after election day. It's just very strange. And I think a lot of what we see from Trump supporters specifically, as opposed to just like general Republicans, is that they are organized in their own weird way, but I don't think that they have the majority in the country that they seem to think they do. And especially in that last tweet or quote that you had from the New York Times, It is interesting because what I think will happen is that after Trump properly loses the election, after Biden's inaugurated, he'll go away. He'll have, you know, a niche on the internet where he is, but the mainstream media doesn't have to cover him anymore. And that's how he gets a lot of his publicity and like that. So I think the Trump coalition of the Republican Party, I think that'll dwindle or go into hiding maybe. But I think 2021 will be a lot easier as far as, you know, how mentally taxing the last 4 years have been.
Okay, let's clip that out and we will return to that in a year and see if things are actually better. We'll see. I thought 2019 was rough.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Donald Trump's legal team is filled with idiots, psychos, and insane people. And we've got one of those for you here. Joe DiGenova, who I didn't even know was actually still involved with the Trump legal effort, but apparently is, was on Newsmax recently, the go-to source of information for the American right wing. And here is what he had to say about the security of the last election.
Anybody who thinks that this election went well, like that idiot Krebs, who used to be the head of
cyber. Oh, yeah, the guy that was on 60 Minutes last night.
That guy is a class A moron. He should be drawn and quartered, taken out at dawn and shot.
Joe, what happens next? The last question, what happens next?
More midnight oil, Howie. More cases being analyzed and more stuff being...
Okay, so we left the rest of that in after the saying that this former head of the cybersecurity and infrastructure security agency should be executed by the state. Just to give you an idea of what Newsmax is. So he said this guy should be murdered, and the host did this. So what's next for you? They're like, they want to be the next Fox News. And that's Yasmin, that is how they responded to an offer of execution for a guy. We'll describe what his crimes are against the Republican Party, but that was a very casual threat for murder.
It's not even just, you know, this guy should be killed. It's drawn and quartered. It's so barbaric, you know, it's so personal. It's so deep. It's, maybe you haven't heard about that since, you know, the 1800s, people being drawn and quartered. But the fact that, like you said, the host just kind of laughed it off and moved on indicates to me that maybe he recognizes that that was very uncouth and wanted to move on from it. Or was just maybe just a little bit incredulous about it. You know, I feel like if somebody said that to me, I'd be like, all right, you know, like I don't know what else to say about that. Like, okay, you know, like let's just talk about something else right now. I don't know if that's the case. There does seem to be a gap in the media right now for Trump supporters because they've been betrayed by their beloved Fox News. So I guess we'll have to keep an eye on Parler and Newsweek and all those guys.
Yeah. Newsmax, to be fair. Well, I can't vouch for Newsweek necessarily, but I don't want Newsmax to be murdered. Let me just be clear about that. Anyway, Chris Krebs, if someone watching this hasn't really been following the insane back and forth after the election, was fired as head of the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency on the 17th of November, not long after he said that the election was the most secure in American history. He also used Twitter to publicly debunk Trump's conspiracy theories. He set up a website as well that just took a lot of the things that were being passed around on the right and pointed out why they weren't true. And in his defense, he would sort of know because he was the head of the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. But anyway, that was enough that now he is a criminal. At best, a thought criminal. At worst, they actually want him to be ripped apart by rampaging stallions. And so this guy that was on Newsmax, I was gonna say he's not just some random weirdo. It's that he's not just some random. He is a random weirdo, but he also defended the president in the Russia investigation and is now involved in attempts to overturn results in battleground states. Although to be fair, they've only won one out of like 40. There's probably more losses since that graphic was made. But he is involved in the Trump legal effort and he's going on right-wing media and calling for those who criticize the president to be murdered. And I'm sure he'll say it was a joke or whatever. Okay, I guess I could go on Don Lemon and just say that Sidney Powell should be, I'm not even gonna say it because that's crazy, but that isn't how it actually works. He is a lawyer and a lawyer for the president. And the bar is buried deep underground where he wants Chris Krebs to be actually. But really fast, it's not just him. Sidney Powell, who admittedly was a bit too crazy for the Trump camp, and they said that she had never been involved with them, even though she was involved in their press conferences. She is still being brought on Fox Business, Lou Dobbs and all of that. I believe on Fox News as well. She might've been on Sean Hannity recently. Even though she's not technically involved in their legal effort, she is involved in legal challenges to the votes. She retweeted this image. We're not gonna read the entire thing, but it calls for military tribunals to be set up to investigate cyber warfare during the election. Also to cancel the upcoming elections. Those Georgia runoffs shouldn't actually exist. The inauguration should be canceled, all of that. Like this is the intellectual merit of his legal team, present and past, that they think those who criticize them should be murdered. And you know, those who were involved in it should at the very least be investigated by military tribunals. And let's keep it real, probably executed. Because at the end of the day, all of this Republican stuff ends with Democrats being executed. And that's who's out there. It's probably gonna fail, but that is the legal effort that's going on right now.
Yeah, it's pretty scary too to hear things like that from lawyers who are working directly with the president. And even if he comes out later, he says, oh, I was joking, that was said in jest. They know what they're doing because the minute that that quote is out there, I mean, we're talking about it right now, it's public, you know? So even if he comes out later and says, oh, I was just kidding, that doesn't make headlines the way the initial thought or tweet or voicemail makes headlines. And that's what people hear, that's what they remember. And then they say, well, that's really what he meant. And it was only, you know, the left-wing media made him apologize. So all these things, all these little things that they say, they just plant little seeds in people's brains. And now you have the country that we have.
Yeah.
Partially.
Yeah, look, I wouldn't joke about murdering my political opponents, but let's say that hypothetically I did. We're being watched by Dragon Squad. And I don't know everybody in Dragon Squad, but I know that there's not much of a like hunger, a thirst for the blood of Republicans. I'm not getting inundated by super chats calling for them to be murdered. It's just not a thing. But on the right, like what is the entire QAnon thing? Like the surface level, it's about feet being broken and all of that. But at the end of the day, it's about the storm. And the storm is when finally we dispense with all of this, and the Democrats are rounded up and the deep state is rounded up and they're executed. That is what they're hoping will happen. And so calling, like joking about the murder of your political opponents kind of is context dependent. When you are a person in a position of authority over a movement that longs for the murder of its political opponents and is going to be really frustrated when it doesn't happen and is very well armed too, I think you should take that into account when making jokes about murder. Maybe choose your words more carefully if indeed you were actually just joking and not offering up a solution to the problem from your point of view.
Yeah, unless that's what they want, you know. And it is strange because I feel like, especially progressives, or let's say me specifically, right? A lot of the things that I do, the work that I do with local Democratic groups and, you know, with my videos and things like that, all of it is motivated by helping other people, right? That's always the goal. It's always, you know, a better planet or a better lifestyle for certain groups or whatever the case is. But with the, you know, I guess if you wanted to say the progressives are on the polar left, if you look at the polar right, who we often get juxtaposed with, it's so hateful. Mm-hmm. It's just hate. That's all it is. You know, there's no reason for it. And it's just a lot of anger. And especially the last 4 years, even after they won this election, they were still angry for 4 years. And they're still so afraid of others. And they're so afraid of losing their power, whatever power they think they have, you know, whether or not they actually have the power is a whole other discussion. So you have all these people who are just angry, maybe angry at the wrong people, maybe as in definitely angry at the wrong people, at the wrong groups. And I don't know how to make them less angry at this point.
You're totally right. I'm glad that you acknowledge, like they seemed angrier once Trump won. And they had the Senate and they even had the House for a couple of years. And even like before the election, so sure, they're gonna be mad now. You know, they lost and they know it deep down. But also they got like a super majority in the Supreme Court and they're angrier than we are. It's really weird. It is very weird. I'm glad that you acknowledge that. Anyway, let's move on to another story because there's a lot of other important stuff going on right now that doesn't necessarily have to do with Donald Trump trying to end American democracy or get his political opponents killed. Okay, there have been a lot of bad people in 2020, but you gotta kind of put at least in the top 20, Scott Atlas, because he really represents in one person the herd immunity lack of strategy for dealing with COVID-19. And he has been a part, a sort of increasingly public part of the increasingly public acknowledgement that Donald Trump does support herd immunity. The idea that we're just not gonna do anything. And a lot of people will get sick and a lot of people will die and eventually we're done, I guess. Well, at least as of today, Scott Atlas, the guy who was the avatar of that murderous public health philosophy and strategy, is gonna be moseying on back down that dusty trail. He has resigned his White House position on Monday. Although it's not, it would have been really good if he'd been fired or something for knowing absolutely nothing about this. Again, he has no expertise in infectious disease. He's a radiologist. He's technically a doctor, true, but doesn't know anything about this. He was only brought on for a limited term initially, and his term was set to expire this week. It is interesting that he's like leaving seemingly right before the expiration of his term. I don't know if that's to provide plausible deniability where he can say, I left willingly, I don't know. But on his way out, he said this, I worked hard with a singular focus to save lives and help Americans through this pandemic. I always relied on the latest science and evidence without any political consideration or influence. That is the biggest bag of disease lies that I've ever seen in my life. He literally joined the team because he spread misinformation on Fox News and Donald Trump only gets new people from Fox News to hold that position, to crowd out Dr. Fauci and to try to bar any action from happening. Anything that would save lives, he just occupied the space as an obstacle. Relied on the latest science and evidence. He wouldn't understand the latest science and evidence. It's not even his field. And he would constantly spread misinformation that like, we don't know if mask wearing is actually helpful and children can't spread the coronavirus. Oops, they can and they can die from the coronavirus. But he doesn't have to actually admit that he was wrong in that way. Hopefully history will acknowledge the part that he played in this needless massive loss of ever continuing American lives. But at least Yasmin, today we have a little bit of good news. He is no longer involved with the response to the pandemic that wasn't even really a response.
Yeah, I think it's so funny how a radiologist can just go on Fox News and all of a sudden he has like a high level position in the White House doing a job that he has no business doing. And I think especially whenever people hear about doctors, they think they're all the same. A radiologist is not the same as what Dr. Fauci is. You know, there's different expertise that people kind of say, oh, well, you know, he's smart enough to be a radiologist. I'm sure he can figure out infectious disease. No, it's a whole other field of study. You know, you would have to dedicate some time to that first. But I love a good I told you so moment, and I feel like I'm having one right now. And I was just talking to someone the other day and I was like, yeah, you know, we decided collectively as a globe that herd immunity was not going to work because millions of people would have to die before it became effective. And it's like the US government was like, we'll just do it anyway. You know, we just won't do anything. And, but even then, you know, what's the death count at? 250, 60,000 Americans so far have died from the coronavirus. It would, we would need like a million, at least a million more, the projections say, before we hit herd immunity. A million more American deaths, US deaths only. So that's not even around the world. It's just, it's not plausible. And these people are killing us. And there's no other way around it. There's no other way to say that. There's no way to sugarcoat it because that's what's happening.
Yeah, you're 100% right. According to the most recent numbers that I saw today, they would expect something like 1.385 million Americans would die as a result of pursuing this strategy. Again, assuming that herd immunity even works with COVID-19, which has not been like robustly established, that you do establish total immunity that lingers for a long enough period of time for that strategy to even work. So this strategy, which again is not a strategy, it's just not doing anything because they don't want to do anything because they don't care and it costs money that they don't want to spend, would, if it works, kill two civil wars worth of Americans, more than two civil wars and four Vietnams worth of Americans. If it works, that is, if anything, if Scott Atlas is remembered in history, and I doubt that he will, it will be for advocating for that. I don't know if he should feel like he should feel guilt. He was, after all, just brought on to advocate for the thing that Trump already believed. I don't think that he convinced Trump of absolutely anything. Trump hasn't wanted to do anything about the pandemic since day one. But if he's remembered, it will be as a guy that advocated for a strategy that would kill over a million Americans. Good work. Although in his defense, again, he doesn't really know anything about infectious disease. He probably doesn't even know those numbers.
But he still took the job.
Yep, he did. And he probably got paid more in the couple of months he worked in that than me and you all year.
Oh yeah.
Anyway, okay, let's push on to one more story before we touch base with the audience again. This is an important one. And I know that you're gonna have a lot to say about it. A group of more than 80 different organizations have put together a letter advocating for incoming President Joe Biden to finally cut off support for the war on Yemen that has claimed so many lives. This US-backed assault led by Saudi Arabia and the UAE began back during President Barack Obama's administration when Biden was vice president. But the letter notes that since then, more than a dozen senior Obama administration officials, including Susan Rice, Samantha Power, Ben Rhodes, and Jake Sullivan, have called for an end to US participation in the war. And they say that the Biden-Harris administration has a historic opportunity to end US complicity in this war the moment you come into office. Now, he backed the war when he was vice president, but a lot has changed since then, and the death toll has skyrocketed since then. And as they point out, many former Democrats who were involved in that administration have acknowledged that they were wrong. So hopefully this is an opportunity to rethink America's role in that conflict, Yasmin.
Yeah, this conflict, there really is a lot to it. They call it a Yemeni civil war, which in and of itself is a bit of a misnomer. So whenever you look at any of the individual conflicts going on in the Middle East right now, there's a few common tropes that continuously come up almost every time, right? One of the big ones is the ideological differences between the Sunni Muslims and the Shia Muslims. Then if you take the individual conflicts and you expand further, it always comes down to Saudi Arabia versus Iran. Then if you go out even further, then you get the US versus Russia. And then there's also the UK and Canada and other large Western powers that are there. And it always, always, always comes back down to oil. And that's why we're there. You know, that's why we went to the Middle East in the first place. You know, that's why we have such a strong presence there. And if you look at the map of Yemen, the entire northern border is Saudi Arabia, right? So any kind of instability in Yemen is worrisome for Saudi Arabia. There's also some political implications there. They don't want Iran to have too much influence in Yemen because that's too close to them. And ultimately, it threatens the oil supply. That's what it comes down to. So as far as pulling out of the conflict, it's going to be very, very difficult. We made a huge mess over there with the Obama administration. You know, we dropped a lot of bombs. They weren't really targeted bombs, and it, you know, contributed to the biggest humanitarian crisis on the in the entire world right now. I mean, there's starvation, there was a cholera epidemic, and this is all before coronavirus even hit. There's rape going on, you know, there's blockades, so people can't get supplies. You have social workers who are just not taking salaries for years at a time because there's no money to pay them, but they still have to do the work. So it really is kind of crazy. As far as pulling out, we absolutely have to. You know, there's no denying the very, very direct link to the lives that we live here in the United States to the catastrophe that's happening over in Yemen. We're directly complicit in all of it, all for oil so we can live the lifestyle that we live. But as far as pulling out of the entire Middle East, it's all so integrated and convoluted, it's going to be difficult. I'm sure a lot of people want to pull out. I don't know what the path forward is specifically on how to get there. I think a big chunk of it will be energy independence and less dependence specifically on oil. But yeah, we'll see how far off that is.
Well, it certainly is complicated and interconnected, but I also think that, you know, theoretically pulling out of literally every conflict that we've unnecessarily gotten ourselves involved in is one thing. Ending some specific elements of our support for the war on Yemen, I think, is a simpler situation to solve. Although, as you point out, we have to acknowledge the context of why we're involved in the first place to do that. But really fast, I want to give you a little bit more information. One of our elected representatives who's been pushing for an end to this for a very long time was involved in invocations of the War Powers Act to try to get us out of that is Ro Khanna, who's joined us on the Damage Report to talk about this exact subject multiple times. He tweeted, "Yemen is the world's worst humanitarian catastrophe. Ending any US support for the Saudis' war should be a top priority in the Biden administration." I'm sure he's going to be putting a lot of pressure on them to do exactly that. And by the way, the most updated numbers, this is as of today, during the conflict is 233,000 deaths in Yemen, including 131,000 from indirect causes such as lack of food, health services, and infrastructure. Looking ahead to the next year, as many as 24.3 million people will need some form of humanitarian assistance and protection. And that's with the ongoing conflict. Like, it's not just the disastrous aftermath. There's still gonna be a war being waged on these people as they need help with things like continuing cholera outbreaks, food inaccessibility, and things like that. In terms of what can actually be done, we do have suggestions, including coming from Hassan Al-Tayeb, lead Middle East policy lobbyist for the Progressive Organization Friends Committee on National Legislation, who has also joined us on the Damage Report on multiple different occasions. He said, by executive order, Biden could get the Pentagon to end intelligence sharing for the Saudi coalition airstrikes, end logistical support, end spare parts transfers that keep Saudi warplanes in the air. He could restore humanitarian assistance to northern Yemen. He could use his power as president to put pressure on other nations that are supporting the Saudi coalition, like France, the UK, and Canada, and get them to follow suit. He could have the State Department put a stop on all arms sales to Saudi Arabia unless they meet certain benchmarks. Now, that's a lot of different tools, but they're also, everyone seems like common sense, and they're all things that Biden can just do. Like, he doesn't need Mitch McConnell to sign on to it or anything like that. He can do these things. A lot of it is diplomatic. Some of it can be done via executive orders, but he can do all of that. And that would do a great deal of the work to save some lives, make it more difficult for Saudi Arabia to continue the way they've been waging war up until this point.
Yeah, and it's important to remember that the US backs Saudi Arabia. You know, we work very closely with them because of their oil. And Saudi Arabia, I don't think they liked Obama very much, but they love Trump. They also love George W. Bush before him. They worked with them to get the oil. And so that's why a lot of times you'll see the US kind of just treating Saudi Arabia very, very delicately, even when we really should not. And the only reason is because we're worried about losing our grip on the oil over there. And just the general instability, and then also, you know, keeping Russia out of the Middle East. There's a lot going on. So it's gonna be a mess, but at this point it's unacceptable how bad it is in Yemen. So something has to happen.
Exactly. And look, if Biden wants to demonstrate that America's changed, that we've moved on from Trump, I mean, this is one of the easiest, most significant ways that he can almost immediately do it on day one. Trump has, you know, he's made these massive arms deals with Saudi Arabia and all of that, loves working with them, even though it's the weirdest thing that his base doesn't seem to have an issue with that, even though they're super suspicious of the Saudis generally. I've never really understood that. But anyway, this would be a great thing that Biden could do. It's one of the many things we'll be watching for as he begins his first term. Joe Biden's holiday celebrations were thrown into a little bit of chaos when he apparently suffered an injury, or at least that's what he wants you to believe. The news says Joe Biden broke his foot while playing with the family dog. And that news has been all over. I personally don't like that all of these articles seem to be implying that it's the dog's fault. Honestly, back off the dog, it was Biden. But according to his doctor, Kevin O'Connor said initial x-rays did not show any obvious fracture, but his clinical exam warranted more detailed imaging. Follow-up CT scan confirmed hairline fractures of President-elect Biden's lateral and intermediary cuneiform bones, which are in the midfoot. It is anticipated that he will likely require a walking boot for several weeks. So Yasmin, apparently he's an older guy and he was playing around and he got a little bit too vigorous with it. And so he hurt his foot, which, you know, he's an older guy. There are concerns about his health and everything. What did you think about this little health mishap for the president-elect?
It's just silly. You know, if this is the kind of news that we have to look forward to for the next 4 years, then I am fully on board. I'm okay with this. I think the only thing when I initially heard about this story that I was annoyed with was like, man, everybody's already talking about how he's such an old man and he's not, you know, I don't want to say anything or knock on some kind of wood, but so that's the only thing that I thought of was, you know, it'll just be another, you know, opportunity for people to be like, he's too old to be president, whatever. I don't care. But it is funny. I didn't know about all the conspiracy theories surrounding this foot thing until you and I were talking earlier, and I need to dive heavily into that later.
Conspiracy? You think these, oh yeah, he just broke his foot playing with his dog. That's what the deep state dog
too
wants
simple.
You to believe.
It's too easy. No. Yeah.
Way too easy. Yeah, Biden is obviously lying. But what actually happened is very clear. It was predicted by none other than Julian's Rum, who I like, not as much as Cat Turd, but I like Julian's Rum, who says the Biden boot is coming with an image. Because there you see Hillary with the boot and John McCain with the boot. They both had boots at one point, and now Biden has a boot. Do you get where I'm going with this? No, neither do I, but let's press on. Neon Revolt says, sure, Chief, sure, he just broke his foot. Das Boot cometh. They know that something's up, even though we don't know what. Zeltan Physics says, it's happening right before your eyes. What do you want to bet? It's just like Hillary in the Nameless One's boots. Justice is coming. But what does this all mean? Well, it means this. He didn't wear the boot because he broke his foot. He wore the boot because he has an ankle monitor on, because he's been arrested, because the storm is coming. And so he, like Hillary and John McCain, are wearing the boot to cover up the fact that the government has arrested them, because Q's prophecies are all coming true. And this is literally what they actually believe is happening.
Why is John McCain involved in this? Why?
Because he was bad. He was bad.
Yeah, he's a bad Republican. He's not a real Republican right now, right? But like, how do they even come up with this stuff? It's like L. Ron Hubbard. He was, you know, a science fiction writer. Then he started a religion. I feel like that's what we're witnessing right now. It feels very similar to the start of Scientology.
Yeah. It's so disgusting that I'm glad that John McCain doesn't have to hear this, because obviously he passed away a couple of years ago of cancer. Or did he? Because they believe he committed suicide so that he wouldn't have to go to Guantanamo Bay. These are all things they actually believe, and there are millions of them. They are legion, literally. But no, they believe that Joe Biden has been arrested, and he is covering up his ankle monitor because the government, which is secretly arresting people behind the scenes, is releasing them with ankle monitors, according to them, and just the normal kind that like people use that you can cover up with a boot. Why make it secret if you've arrested them? Why not track them in a different way? Why do you need the ankle monitor? He appears in public all the time. You know where he is. None of this makes any sense. Why is it still a secret? like you like that thing about Hillary was years ago. They just like left her out for years. What are they waiting for? None of this makes any sense. And by the way, you might think that the theory I'm saying they believe is that Joe Biden is wearing an ankle monitor, but that's not technically what they're saying because they don't believe that's Joe Biden. Take a look at this. They believe through careful analysis of Joe Biden's ears that he's a clone of Joe Biden. So wait, did they ankle monitor the clone? The clone didn't commit any crimes. It only existed for a couple of years. But they also believe that he died. Is it a zombie? Is it a clone of a zombie? Why did they arrest the zombie clone? But these are things that they actually believe. And these people, there are nearly as many Congress people who believe this stuff as are strong progressives in America. They've got a squad almost as big as ours at this point.
I think this is a lot of fun for me. All of this is hilarious. I don't know why Joe Biden's been arrested. That hasn't come up. You know, what has he done that's worthy of being arrested? And I like how we're gonna arrest him, put an ankle monitor on him, make him fake a foot injury to put a boot on, and we're still gonna inaugurate him in January. Like, that's fine. That none of it makes any sense. But
The way I see it
is like, let them occupy themselves with this and just like, you know, you guys do that. It's fine. You know, it's worrisome they're attracting more followers, but they
that's
seem
my
harmless.
Fear. I mean, like, I wish that I could agree, but the thing is, like, not only are they attracting followers and ruining families. I mean, I'm sure there's people watching this right now that have lost relatives to this insanity. But every once in a while, they have some murderous plot that they either follow through with or thankfully get stopped beforehand. But QAnon supporters have been ready to commit acts of violence in multiple cases, including related to the election. And so when you keep telling them that Joe Biden is about to be arrested, so don't worry, he's not gonna be president, but it's not true, and he is gonna be president. What happens to that fragile mind when they realize that the Q thing isn't true? I don't know. Here's an idea. The reason that Joe Biden is wearing a boot and that Hillary Clinton was wearing a boot and Joe Biden was wearing a boot is because they're really old. They're all really old people, and really old people break their bones sometimes. It just happens. That's a thing that happens. And you guys should not be shocked by this. And I'm speaking to the QAnon people as you guys, even though they're certainly not watching this. You guys pivoted from saying that Joe Biden is so fragile, he won't last a month, to, well, now any injury is proof that he's been arrested. He couldn't ever injure himself. You thought he was falling apart at the seams. But they forget it when it becomes more exciting to have his injuries be ephemeral. Anyway.
I mean, it's funny because that was my initial concern, was that they were gonna talk about how old he is and falling apart. But then they just like went in a completely different direction. So my initial worry, I don't have to worry about it anymore. You know, they just, it's like the things that they come up with is just like, as a writer, I'm impressed. I wish I could come up with something like that.
I do wonder, because it does come out of like, you know, it gets distributed so quickly, and then all of a sudden a lot of people are talking about it, and then they add new wrinkles to it. Like, I did a live video about the Kraken thing, and they all believe it's some different military program, but somebody came up with the idea that it was a military program. Is this basically like fanfic? Is QAnon political fanfic?
That's what it feels like. That's really what it feels like, and I've been known to like dive into some fanfic circles just to see what's going on in there. And they're strange. They're very strange. And a lot of this, it's all very disjointed too, right? So it's not coming from any one source specifically. It's like somebody says something and then somebody else is like, oh, maybe this too. And so I think that's why it's so fragmented and just, you know, illogical, nonsensical, hard to follow. That's the nature of these things.
Yeah. You know, I'm glad that you said that, because we're gonna do this last story, and we're gonna be going from QAnon and all of the weird loops of fake logic that don't make any sense and arguments that fall apart if you scratch the surface even a little bit. We're gonna go to Ben Shapiro, and we're gonna experience the same exact thing. Now, Ben Shapiro would have you believe that these are very different groups. QAnon's just a bunch of random crazies. Ben Shapiro's an intellectual gladiator. We're gonna see if that's actually true. So let's launch into this last story. We're in the holiday season, which means tons of holiday themed rom-coms to appeal to a lot of different people. And that is where Ben Shapiro gets a little bit whiny, because apparently this year, Hulu has one of their holiday related romantic movies features a lesbian couple, and that infuriates him. But not really, because he's gonna keep saying that they're allowed to do whatever they want, but he knows that his whole grift is complaining about social stuff like this, so he's trying to have it both ways. So here's a little bit of his commentary from this week.
So Hulu decided this year that they were gonna make their holiday pitch a lesbian rom-com. Now, listen, they can do whatever they want. Free country, company can do what it wants. Typically, when you're talking about a religious holiday, which is what Christmas is, I mean, it is a secular holiday for many Americans, but it also happens to be a religious holiday. Typically, you celebrate that by, you know, celebrating things that don't directly cut against a lot of religious sensibilities, but that's the direction Hulu has gone. And they've gone that direction so far that they've decided, the entertainment industry, that they have to go to places like Hallmark and then browbeat them into making pieces on lesbian and gay couples, even though the main constituency for Hallmark is largely religious families with small children. You know, that's their prerogative. All these are free companies. They can do what they want, but it means that conservatives can and should build alternatives. Again, I'm not even saying that it's terrible to make a movie about, you know, that's a lesbian rom-com. Make whatever you want. All I'm saying is that if you're a conservative with conservative sensibilities, at a certain point, you might get sick of the fact that Hollywood only wants to make the kinds of movies that you despise, right? And only wants to make the kind of movies that slap your sensibilities in the face and treat you like you're a fool. Again, that movie from Hulu apparently is, I haven't seen it yet, so I'm going by the reviews, which are, of course, 100% positive. The movie is all about how a conservative family learns that all of their religious values have been a bunch of crap for years, which is always exciting news.
Okay, so Yasmin, I'm gonna give you first crack at this. So he has an issue with the fact that Hulu is trying to appeal to lesbian or LGBTQ audiences, or just people who don't mind seeing couples that don't look exactly like themselves. What did you think about his critique of that?
Oh, I haven't listened to Ben Shapiro speak in a long time, and I forgot just how much I don't like listening to him speak. So that's what I was dealing with during that entire clip. But also, what's the problem? You know, these conservatives, they still have the Hallmark Channel. Just go to the Hallmark Channel, you know? If you don't want that, go to Hulu. What's the problem? Why is this a thing, you know? But, you know, as someone who has been known to watch many a Hallmark movie in my time, they're all terrible and they're all so predictable. They're all the same thing, you know? But more importantly, you only see the same, you know, white American couples. You know, it's always, you know, the young, bright blonde girl from the big city, and she goes back to her small town and, you know, finds the meaning of Christmas and falls in love, right? That's how every single one of these movies goes. As far as, you know, introducing LGBT couples into it, or even, you know, more races than just white people, that would be fun too. It doesn't really contradict conservative values. It depends on how you look at it, I guess. You know, for evangelicals, absolutely it does. But as far as like family and Christmas, all of that is still part of America. It's still part of people, you know? I think conservative Americans really want to hone in on this one very narrow view of what Americans should be. And the reality that they're fighting against is just imploding in on them and they can't handle it. So, you know, let them complain about what Hulu's up to. It's fine. Progress happens whether or not people want it to happen. It just does. You know, you have conservatives, you have obstructionists, you know, people who want to everything to stay the same. It's not going to. Nothing ever stays the same. So in and of itself, their platform is flawed. So
yeah, he can say whatever he wants. I hope that, especially because most of his work is online, that if we can save a few people from his thing, that's a good thing. And his thing is, he speaks really, really fast with the aura that he's making some sort of logical, cogent argument. But those two things are actually quite related, because he speaks so fast that you don't realize how many ways he's undercutting his own argument. So I have his argument actually written out in front of me. So just briefly, let's go through a few of the issues with the case that he's making. I mean, the overall case is, it's totally fine for them to do whatever they want. And indeed, I'm a massive capitalist, so that's what I want. I want them to make whatever they want, and I want them to make a product that's gonna sell. But also, I have to make a product, and the product is complaining about their product, so I have to pretend that it's an issue, even though I keep saying it's not an issue, which is sort of an issue for him. But inside of this, he says, typically Christmas is a religious holiday. This is what Christmas is. I mean, it's a secular holiday for many Americans, but it also happens to be a religious holiday. Typically, you celebrate that by, you know, celebrating things that don't directly cut against a lot of religious sensibilities. But you just said it's not a religious holiday for a lot of Americans. For some, it's a secular holiday. I would say for the vast majority, but we can quibble about the numbers. Why then wouldn't some of the movies appeal to those who celebrate Christmas as a religious thing, and some would appeal to people who don't? You just said that there's those two markets, but you don't want them to exploit those two markets. He then says that the entertainment industry has gone to Hallmark and Hulu to browbeat them. But what are you talking about? Like, the entertainment industry isn't going to those things. They're the one making the movies. That doesn't even make any sense. And Hallmark still makes, as Yasmin was saying, tons of stereotypical straight white, snowy white Christmas movies. They've made tons of them. Later in the argument, he says, at a certain point, sure, they can do whatever they want, but don't you get mad that they only make the sort of crap that makes fun of you? What are you talking about? They make dozens of these movies every single year that are specifically designed to people like you that want your couple to be straight and white and you want your wops to not be woppy. They make those for you all day long. They have like literally one for lesbians. It's so few that you can focus on it specifically on your show. And I think Hallmark had one with a gay couple, like one. Even if they stopped, which they're never going to, you could go back and you could watch hundreds and hundreds of horrible, repetitive, formulaic movies if that's what you actually wanted. But you don't want that. He doesn't care about this movie. He just admitted he's not going to watch it. He has no idea if it's any good. The only evidence he provides is that the reviews are really positive, but he finds that to be proof that it's bad, not that it's good. And he tomorrow isn't even going to remember that it exists. It is a digestible bit of right-wing fast food that he is offering up to his audience, that he gets them all worked up about. If you asked him what his political philosophy is about going forward, what his politics are about, he would say it's, you know, fiscal responsibility and some sort of real politic, foreign policy. And yet his show always ends up being about stuff like this. And he cares so little that he can't even prosecute the case against it. He undercuts it in 1,000 different ways. By the way, if you want, you can go on Media Matters. You can read it for yourself. It falls apart in even the most shallow rereading of what he's saying there.
I thought it was interesting too what you said about, you know, there's so many other movies that he could be watching, but he's worried about this one. And it's almost like this lesbian Christmas movie is insulting him personally as a straight white Christian man. It's like, oh, who feels sorry for you, Ben Shapiro? Whose sympathy are you looking for right now? And where are you expecting to find it? Because it's not here. You know, it's really, yeah. It's really hard when there's, yeah, like hundreds of terrible Christmas movies and then one lesbian one. Who cares? There's more important things to worry about right now.
His argument is, he would say, the only point that I'm trying to make is that conservatives and religious conservatives need to make their own movies. What are you talking about, dude? They already do. There are multiple companies that do that. I don't remember the guy's name. The guy that like in the 80s was in sitcoms.
Kevin Sorbo. He's in all of them.
Kevin Sorbo. Exactly.
Yeah.
And how do those do? How do those do? They exist.
Not well.
I would argue the audience isn't there, really big.
No. Exactly.
Kirk Cameron. Yeah, thank you, more Fallon.
Kirk Cameron. Oh, yeah. Well, his sister, she's in all those Hallmark movies now.
Who is his sister?
Candace Cameron Burr.
Yes.
The girl from DJ Tanner from Full House.
And the fact that movie exists infuriates me to no end. No, it doesn't. Anyway, we are unfortunately a little bit over, but Yasmin, thank you as always for joining us. Great to have you here. Where can people see more of your work?
More of my work. So my work right now is on hiatus a little bit because we are working on some new stuff, hopefully launching early next year. We're looking at a podcast, like a video podcast kind of situation. So it's going to be similar content from what you've gotten from me previously on my Instagram or on YouTube. You can find it. A lot of explainers about kind of what's going on in the world, topics like Yemen, like what we discussed earlier. So a lot of that, that people can kind of understand more about the world that we're all living in.
Awesome. Well, you'll have to come back on the show around when you launch in the new year so we can send people to them. And thank you again.
Absolutely. Thank you. Bye.
Very excited to welcome to the show for the first time, the author of The Black Friend on Being a Better White Person, Frederick Joseph. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Hey, John, thanks for having me.
Glad to have you here. And today, as we're filming this, your book has just been released. By the time people are seeing this, it will be available. It's being made available via a Penguin Random House, so everywhere basically. And very excited to talk to you about the book, why you chose this as a project, sort of the reaction that you're getting. So tell me a little bit about the premise of The Black Friend.
Yeah, so The Black Friends, a nonfiction, and it's part toolkit, part reflection, and it's all interesting. You know, I chose to write the book because I was actually on my way to work one day, and I sat next to a white woman on the subway, and she clutched her purse, got up, and moved to another seat. And I tweeted out, I'm like, you know, I'm gonna write a book on white people just being better, right? Like, not a book on how, you know, slavery happened or how Jim Crow took place, nothing academic, just like a book about microaggressions, daily manifestations of racism. And people were super interested. They're like, yes, please, we don't have that. So this is what that is, right? Like, again, I think that there are plenty of books out there for academic context. This is more so conversational, empathy building. It's again, the daily manifestations of the things that we know are wrong, but how they show up in the lives of non-white people.
Yeah, and so I know that you wrote it, but you also brought together a number of other awesome contributors to give, like, so to some extent it's forward looking, it's a toolkit for changing behavior in the future, but it's also a catalog of things that people experienced that are small things, but that they remember and that have been a part of their life, involving music and involving food and involving all of these things, sort of like almost cataloging these bits of suffering that accrue over time. So how did you go about bringing together this group of individuals to contribute to the book?
Well, you know, for me, I knew from jump that I wanted other people's perspective and lived experiences, because I think one thing that happens when people are writing like how to do this or how to not be that is that it comes from a silo of self-experience, right? So I said, okay, if I'm gonna ask white people to not do certain things, it shouldn't just be my voice. So I picked people who come from varied lived experience, right? Like, there are black people, there are multiple black people in the book, but each of them is a different type of black person, right? You have like Angie Thomas, who wrote The Hate U Give. And, you know, her and I were talking about literary blackface and how, like, you can't develop characters who just happen to be black without altering your entire story based on their experiences. And then, you know, I also speak to Jamil Hill, and she's, you know, taking more of an angle as someone who's like a very public figure and the things that she's dealt with. There's also people in the book who are from the Latinx community, people who are from the indigenous American community, so the indigenous people of America's community, so on and so forth. So, you know, for me, I wanted that affirmation in the book because I didn't want to say like, hey, white people do this, and white people just argue with me like, no, we don't. I'm like, well, here's a bunch of other people saying, yes, you do. So,
you know, it's interesting that you bring that up, because it seems like one of the challenges is, so it's designed to help these white people be better, but the worse those white people are, it seems like they're also gonna be the most resistant to identifying the problem in the first place, let alone thinking it's something that needs to be solved. So how do you go about maneuvering through that challenge?
Well, you know, to be quite frank with you, I think there's a very specific community that I'm targeting with the book. Because I say early on that this isn't, to be quite frank with you, it's not the Trump supporters, right? Like, just gonna be, I'm just calling it out. It's not the people who are supporting overt white supremacy. It's the person who's like, oh, I have a biracial child, and therefore nothing I do is ever racist, right? It's the person who's like, you know, oh, you're a black guy. I never expected you to be into Hall & Oates. Well, why would you not expect me to like Hall & Oates because I'm black? It's those types of exchanges that often happen daily that people just don't see, because it's like, well, I'm not supporting Trump, I'm supporting Biden, and therefore there's no racism in anything that I do. And I'm like, no, oftentimes you're perpetuating the exact same things.
Yeah, it's really interesting that you say that. That there are these things that people think that once I have this, then I'm good. I don't need to improve, I'm protected. You know, as you said, maybe I have a biracial child, maybe I host a talk show on HBO, or, you know, like just today, this morning, I was reading that comedian Sarah Silverman said that she used to use the fact that she was self-identified as a liberal as a cover to tell offensive jokes. Like, it was a way to get out of jail free, effectively. Do you think, How has it been in trying to, like, have you tracked some of your advice on people? Have you sort of workshopped it? Have you seen success in getting people to open their eyes to some of the things that you and others talk about in the book?
Yeah, and I think that the book is already accomplishing what I wanted it to, just based on the people who got advanced copies, right? Like, you have people like Anna Paquin, who played Rogue in X-Men, and you know, she's the star of True Blood, and you know, she's been praising the book. You know, people like Katie Maloney from Vanderpump Rules, white people who on a regular basis are like, okay, I don't think of myself as a bad person. I think of myself as being someone who is, again, liberal, or you know, being a Democrat as a label of non-racist or anti-racist racism. But it's not that, right? You know, people are discovering through these stories that I'm telling, like, you know, one instance in the book that happens is when I was in elementary school, I was the smartest kid in class, you know, best grade, so on and so forth. And we got a substitute teacher who assumed that my grades were a reflection of me cheating on tests. Because she just couldn't believe that the smartest kid in class was a black kid. And she made me take one test that I got the best score on in class multiple times. And I was so embarrassed by having to keep on retaking the test that I ended up doing poorly on it because of the trauma of doing that, right? And I got bad grades the rest of the year because I was so afraid of her. I didn't want her judging me. And then, how do you even explain that as a kid, what you're going through, to your parents or the administration, right? And those are the types of stories that we're telling, because people, again, and she was probably a Democrat. This was Westchester County, New York, right? She probably voted for Clinton, and she's like, I'm doing the right thing, but black kids aren't that smart. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, can I just acknowledge that you know that your book is being read by a lot of very notable people when you just listed some of the people that have been reading it, and you didn't mention that Chelsea Clinton gave like a shout out to the book. That's pretty amazing. I hope to be in that position someday. Finally, about the book, tell me about the Encyclopedia of Racism in the book.
Yeah, so the Encyclopedia of Racism actually came about because my editor and I, after the book was written, you know, we're going back and rereading some of the things that we had in there. And you know, she's like, hey, I came to realize that I don't think that I knew what a lot of these things meant until you started sending me you know, certain definitions, right? Like I'd say like, oh, this is what this means, and this is what that was. Or even like, you know, one of the definitions in there that she did know, but the Tulsa Race Massacre, the destruction of Black Wall Street, you know, that didn't become a major topic in America or globally until the show Watchmen came out. So we came to identify that most people, as you're just talking, unless you're in very specific niche communities, you don't know certain things. Like, you might not know what white privilege even is, right? Like you don't know what Blue Lives Matter means. So all these different things that I bring up in the book, if you're from Texas, if you're from West Texas, why would you understand conceptually what white privilege is? Mm-hmm. No one's talking about it. So, yeah.
I think that that's a great point. I've heard any number of different, like, Fox News personalities argue against the concept of white privilege. And after listening to it, it makes me fairly confident that they don't know what white privilege is being defined to be. But anyway, fascinating. And it is available, The Black Friend on Being a Better White Person, available everywhere where you can buy books, even during a pandemic. By the way, if you enjoy the book, please give it a good review, because disingenuous people are going to do the opposite off the bat.
I'm going to probably have about 100,000 negative reviews by the time this airs. So please.
Exactly. Frederick, I also wanted to talk to you about the political moment we're in, because in the past you've served as a surrogate for both Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, presidential candidates. I was a very big supporter of Bernie Sanders, and obviously, you know, didn't get what I want in any way. But Biden has now won the presidency, and while he's still weeks away from being inaugurated, I think it's 50 days as of us filming this, we are seeing a little bit about, for instance, his picks for his cabinet for some positions. That's caused a lot of controversy over the past few days. As someone who is an outspoken supporter of more progressive candidates, what are you making of the days since the election?
I mean, I think it's exactly what I expected, you know, to be quite frank with you. Even during the election, you know, everyone was saying we could push him left. I'm someone who kind of pushed that rhetoric and narrative on my platforms just because of the fact that Trump is so terrible. But to be really frank, Joe Biden is not doing anything other than what Joe Biden was going to ever do. I think that even in a debate with Donald Trump, he said, I'm up here because I'm not the rest of them. Speaking of the progressive candidates, so on and so forth. So at this point, I think that, you know, the progressive base has to start strategically thinking, well, how do we force him not to go left, but how do we force him to actually be accountable to the people, right? Like Elizabeth Warren and Chuck Schumer have been pushing for Biden to cancel $50,000 in student debt. And I think within a few hours he said 10K, maybe, right? And this shows that we need more strategy, because even his cabinet picks, you know, they leave much to be desired. Right. I know a lot of people have said, oh, his comms team, I think it's an entire comms team comprised of women. But there are also many women who are on the progressive end of things saying, well, you didn't include any progressive women. Right. Yeah. So we have to stop looking at identity politics. And I think that's what this administration is going to be. It's going to be pure identity politics of, okay, there are people from various backgrounds, but what do they actually stand for? So I'm not disappointed. Because it's an expectation at this point.
You know, it's funny because, like, as Biden was running and we're getting closer to the election, like, you know, it took me a while to process the fact that Bernie had lost once again, and that this time it was worse because he's unlikely to run in the future. This was like a more enduring loss than it was back in 2016. And like, I told my followers, you know, like, we've got a choice between these two, and really it's about choosing who you want your opponent to be. And yet I do see a lot of people who, I think months ago, if you'd asked them who's Biden, what's he's gonna do, they had a good read of it, being kind of like really feeling betrayed by some of these picks. And to me, it seems like almost forgetting that we lost, or thinking, hey, maybe we didn't really lose. Like, maybe Biden will be shockingly good, when there hadn't really been much evidence that that was going to be the case. And I think it's almost like sort of an aftershock of grief to discover, no, it's probably gonna be like we thought it might, and he's gonna choose Neera Tanden, and, you know, John Kerry's the best we can hope for on the climate, and, you know, that sort of thing. It's difficult to work through. What do you think about, because you seem pretty level-headed about what he's likely to do, are there any spots where you feel like you do still have an expectation that he could deliver some form of what you want in some policy area, maybe?
No. And the reason I say that is because, you know, it's not just about the cabinet. I think that there's a trickle down effect to even more local elections. And I think there's just kind of a national gaslighting right now, to be quite frank with you, of you can't even be critical of Biden or his administration at this point without being attacked as like being pro-Trump or being anti-America. And I think that's because Trump polarized critique so much, right? So now where we're at, you know, I don't feel good about anything that's going to happen. You know, I said recently, like when he chose Neera Tanden, I think I said one thing about it on Twitter, and I was lambasted as, you know, some evil Bernie bro. You know, people couldn't even understand pure critique of the things that she's actually done. So I don't know that there's an area that we can find where there's going to actually be true change or someone who aligns with my values. You know, even in criminal justice, we just came out of one of the greatest moments of accountability for police and white supremacy in this country, only to be given a candidate who says things like, well, shoot him in the leg instead, right? As opposed to defunding the police. So, you know, I'm not too high on it right now. I don't really know what area, you know, we could look at.
You know, this is probably going to be a question looking too far in the future, because Biden isn't even inaugurated yet. But it seems like the odds of him running for a second term are probably pretty low. I mean, he's already going to be the oldest president ever sworn in. And, you know, Kamala Harris is going to have 4 years of being a national figure as the VP. In 4 years, presumably, more of the Democratic base will be even more progressive than it was through sort of generational change and all of that. What do you think about her future based on what we're seeing right now? Do you think that it's going to be a continuation of sort of Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden, or is she going to stake out a more progressive future for herself when she clearly wants to run for president again at some point?
I think that by technical stance, Kamala will end up being the most progressive person at her level in history. But that's just from a technical standpoint, right? Like, I think she had the most progressive voting history in the Senate, but that also was because many other senators like Bernie, like Elizabeth Warren, so on and so forth, abstained from voting on certain things. So, you know, that's a soundbite that goes around, but that's actually the reality of how that works. So, you know, with her, it's interesting that I think she's movable in many ways that Biden is not, because I think at the end of the day, Biden is an old white guy, right? Like, she's a woman of color. And that does actually mean something. You know, she's surrounded by people who are black and brown people and are suffering within America. Biden actually, frankly, he is, I don't want to say a soundbite that gets me put out there, but he's of the same machine as many people on the right, right? Like, and I don't know that Kamala is exactly that. And that little bit of hope is what I think can show her difference.
Interesting. I mean, of course, we're gonna be seeing, she's gonna be there. Vice presidents don't generally have a lot of autonomous power, but Biden is probably not gonna be the strongest, most vigorous president. So if there's an opening, it'll be with Biden as president. We'll have to see what she does in advance of that eventual run. But Frederick Joseph, thank you once again for joining us. Your book is The Black Friend, available now. I really appreciate you joining us today on the show.
Thanks for having me, John.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.